Hi, this is Allison Sheridan of the NoSillaCast podcast, hosted at podfeed.com, a technology geek podcast with an ever-so-slight Macintosh bias, a proud member of the Tech Podcast Network. If it's tech, it's here. Today is Sunday, May 13th, 2006, and this is show number 43. You might be wondering why I played that music. That's because this is the one-year anniversary of the beginning of the NoSillaCast podcast. I think I can say with confidence that I'm not experiencing any pod fading now, that's for sure. If I can keep it up for a year, I think I'm in this adventure for the long haul. If anything, I think I'm more excited now than I was at the very beginning when I first started off on this. I thought you might enjoy a trip back in time down memory lane and talk about some of the highlights of the last year. When I first started, I did one 9-minute introductory show, and I thought about playing it for you, but it's just so darn pathetic. I couldn't bring myself to do it. If you insist, you can go to the show notes and you can actually hear that very first show. Then the next three that I did were all from the All Things Digital conference. This is an executive conference put on by the Wall Street Journal and hosted by Walter Mossberg and Kara Swisher. I had great fun discussing the show and all the things that were going on with Steve Jobs talking and Bill Gates. And I did the whole thing from my hotel room in San Diego. That's a spectacular conference. One of the funnest things I get to do all year. And I'm looking forward to it this month again. If you're interested in seeing more about the conference, check it out at d.wsj.com. Then I did what 90% of all podcasters do. I stopped. I seemed to think I was going to keep going, but I kind of just didn't. Couldn't figure out what to do next. I've read that most podcasters actually do fade out after about 4 or 5 shows, and then they just disappear. Lucky for me, a fan named Jay Jacobs wrote an email to me, and he said, "Dude, what's up? Where's the NoSillaCast?" Well, that's all it took, just for me to realize that people are actually listening to me to kick it back into gear. By July of 2005, iTunes 4.9 came out, bringing podcasting into the semi-geek mainstream. September is when I finally got into the rhythm of the weekly podcast, and I haven't missed a week since. September also brought the Nano to us. You had to hear all about my first family reunion after 35 years from Michigan, which turned out to be way more fun than I thought it would be because I rediscovered my cousin Anne Marie, who turned out to be an uber geek like me. Oh yeah, we bonded. By October, I was thrilled to see my unique visitor count get up to 178 people. Wow! Funny to look back on that now. But I remember running in to tell my husband about all the people that were listening. It was crazy. October brought the WordPress blog to the site, which is the greatest tool I've ever used. Probably instrumental in me actually keeping the energy up to do this, because without it, I'd never be able to keep the site up to date. It wasn't all joy in October, because that's when I had to tell you about the Samsung debacle and the closure of that whole story. Not that I haven't spent every single month since then reminding you to never buy anything from Samsung. November was probably the greatest month of the year, as that's when the Podcast Expo took place, and I had the great thrill to meet Adam Christensen from the MacCast, Steve Gibson from GRC.com, Todd Cochran of GeekNose Central, John Chambers of the 1 Minute Tip podcast, and best of all, I got to meet my hero, Leo Laporte. His keynote speech was very inspirational. He talked about how if you do what you're passionate about, everything else will just fall into place. So many people at the show were obsessing about, well, how do I make money at it? How do I make money at it? And he said, just do what you're crazy about and it'll all work out. I remember what he said frequently when I'm gearing up to do my podcast. And it really is true. I could spend the rest of this podcast gushing about Leo, but I'll try to restrain myself. If you want to hear more, let me know. I'll gush like crazy. Everyone at the Podcast Expo was so gracious, and it was an honor to be with them all. I really will never forget that event. December and January were filled with Christmas, New Year's, and the Martian death flu, not to mention a car accident, but I still never missed a weekly podcast. I got to admit, there were two or three shows in there where I shifted out one day each time, but I made it through. It was rugged to do it during that time, but I really felt a commitment to the show, and I don't want to disappoint anyone. February was spent playing with the new iLife suite and the arrival of my new MacBook Pro. The MacBook Pro only had a month of adoration before being tortured by having it run Windows using the hack from onmac.net. That happened in March. April's excitement over a new calculator application was shockingly overshadowed by the advent of Bootcamp and, of course, Parallels to run Windows natively without a hack. And that brings us up to May. I want to give heartfelt thanks to all of you who've provided feedback over the last year, sending in questions and comments, and also to those of you who just listen and never write back, or even those of you who only read in the blog. It's all about you. It's all about what makes you happy the way you want to get this information. It's been a year of joy for me, and I thank you for the opportunity to spread my excitement about technology to you all. Hey, I tell you what, let's do it for another year, shall we? Well, it's Mother's Day today, and I got a very exciting present. Ron and Steve went over to Costco and got us a power washer, one of those pressure sprayers. Oh man, if you have not played with one of these, you just haven't lived. It attaches to your regular hose, but then with an electric motor, it increases the pressure until you can take paint off a wall. All right, I exaggerate. The 1800 PSI model from Husky we bought can't quite do that, but it's perfect for us. It's the best thing for us is to be able to take off algae from concrete and stucco walls. You may remember about 6 months ago, I spent 4 hours scrubbing the algae off our stucco walls and pathway, literally wearing holes in my knuckles from the scrub brush. I was really happy about how great it looked, and it was worth the effort. But today, I spent about an hour with so little effort and did a way better job. Steve and I also did our respective halves of the driveway. We were competing, see, to see who did a better job. And it's amazing what color our driveway actually is. It's kind of a salmon color, but it was kind of a dark salmon, and now it's really bright, and there was so much gunk on it that I didn't even realize was there. I can tell this is going to be a new obsession along with washing the cars, but it's a kind of thing that's way more fun when it's really, really gross. So that was a good time. Now, I got to tell you boys out there, I don't think an electric power washer is for every wife and mother and would excite them this much. So I don't recommend that as a gift, but I got to tell you, sure made me happy. By the way, we share custody of our power washer with Ron. We split the cost. So the whole thing only cost us about $80, as it cost about $160 US. It's cool. Last week, I talked about all the things my friend Melissa and I were able to do on her computer while I was out in Virginia, and I knew there was something else I was forgetting. Of course, I remembered it about a half hour after I did the show. Harvey and Melissa both wanted to do instant messaging, but their old computer got all horked up when their son ran AOL's Instant Messenger on it. So instead, I installed an open source program called GAIM, that's G-A-I-M, from game.sourceforge.net. This runs under Windows, and the cool thing about GAIM is that it lets you talk not just to AIM users, but also to MSN Messenger, Yahoo Messenger, IRC, Jabber, and about five more applications. You can even log into multiple IM networks simultaneously. Oh, GAIM does also run under Linux, and it's updated frequently. So if you want an alternative to GAIM, or if you have friends using different protocols, check out GAIM over at sourceforge.net. Let's get into some listener feedback. I got a great email from Phil. He said, "First, I want to thank you for a great podcast, one I never want to miss. I was listening to your number 42 and heard your discussion about computer heat. I think you might find the following widget to be very complete in the reporting of virtually everything in your computer. It's free, and its name is iStat Pro 2.21 from iSlayer.net. Keep up the good work. Best regards, Phil." Well, thanks for the nice praise, Phil, and the tool suggestion. I loaded this, and it has a beautiful interface. It shows you the CPU, memory, network, bandwidth, hard drive, temperatures, fans, and load uptime, which is in one nice little widget. It's really, really pretty. The only problem is, it looks like it doesn't actually work on the Intel-based Macs. It's got really screwy numbers for the memory. Like it says I have 594 megabytes and I don't have 594 megabytes. It gives you wired, inactive, and free, and then active, used, and swapped. And some of that makes a little sense, but not so much of it. It doesn't show the temperature for my machine at all, which of course is the thing I would have been really excited to see. I'd really like to see the temperature at the CPU. It sure does look cool, though, and I think if you have a non-Intel machine, you might want to go check it out. They have a bunch of cool little tools over at iSlayer.net, and I think you should go check those out, too. Last week, I talked about the story going around about some miners who were stuck in a mine for an extended period of time in Tasmania, and everyone was all abuzz about the fact that they sent iPods down to them for entertainment. Well, the real story, of course, is that these guys were stuck in a mine. Why? We didn't hear about this. So after I talked about that last week, I got this great email from Rose, who lives nearby to where the miners were trapped. Here's her own words. G'day, Allison. I live in Hobart, capital of Tasmania, and I thought it would be best to tell you about the miners. They were in a safety cage when the rock fall due to an earthquake occurred. A large rock fell on the roof of the cage, which protected them from the other debris. Thermal imaging equipment discovered they were alive. 14 miners got out on that day, but sadly one did die on about the fourth day. The rescue team was able to drill a 100-millimeter, 4-inch access tunnel through to the cage so they could communicate and send food and water, and later iPods. But due to the extreme hardness of the rock and the need to not risk any more lives, it took another 10 days to free them. These guys are amazing. They walked out. They had to go to hospital to be checked out, but they are all very well. Simply amazing. I'm so pleased to have found your podcast, too. The guys are great, but it's nice to hear a girl geek. I run a cleaning crew at a seafood complex. I work at night, and 3/4 of my work is manual and doesn't demand all of my brain, so that's when I listen to tech podcasts. I also listen to some music podcasts through my Shuffle. If I'm alone on my breaks, I watch movies or tech vidcasts on my 5th-generation iPod. Rose. Rose, thank you so much for telling us the full story here. It's terrible to hear that one of them did pass away, but I'm so glad that the rest of the miners were able to come out safely. It's really a miracle that they were able to survive, and I'm sure it was a harrowing time for all of you in the area. I wonder that we didn't hear about it until the iPod angle came in. I don't actually watch the news very often. It's too depressing, so maybe other people did know about it. That's a great idea to learn while you're working, too. I get bored so easily. I can see how it'd be much more enjoyable on your job with some entertainment. I'm also intrigued that both the Shuffle and the 5th-gen iPod are useful to you. I tend to use my Nano way more than the 5th-gen also. Just something about that size just hits a sweet spot. And I'm really glad you like finding a girl geek. There sure are a lot of boys in this industry. But what would they do without us? By the way, I looked up Tasmania because I wasn't actually sure where it was. Tasmania is an island of southeast Australia consisting of the islands of Tasmania along with several smaller islands and separated by the mainland by Bass Strait. Abel Tasman explored the island in 1642, naming it Van Diemen's Island. It was renamed to his honor in 1853, and Tasmania joined Australia in 1901. Listener Michael wrote in about how he listens to podcasts too, and that was kind of an interesting story. He works in an old factory building in Delft in the west of the Netherlands. It's an interesting place with lots of history. During World War II, they were secretly working on penicillin in this building, so there are old tubes and labels like nitrogen 100 bar and things like that around. Now it's used for small companies in architecture, design, and IT. Michael's a web designer in IT, so that's a great place for him. Evidently, though, he has to sit around alone most of the day, and a good podcast breaks the day up for him. He does prefer audio to video because you can't do something else while you're watching a video. He suggests that I keep to audio unless I'm doing a lesson like I do from time to time, like if I wanted to show a short clip of my shiny car after I wax it. I had asked for feedback on whether I should include the videos in the regular feed, and Michael reflected what most of you said, which is that if the videos are only occasional, it's okay to throw them in the feed. If there ended up being tons of them, you'd actually prefer I create a separate podcast feed for them. I think I'll do that from now on, so don't be shocked if once in a while a little video comes in to teach something. Might be fun. Thanks for the advice for Michael and for the rest of you who provided feedback. Well, I've been hearing about this idea of having virtual desktops. I've heard a lot of people talk about it, and I wanted to get a feel for why you'd want one and what the experience is really like. A virtual desktop application allows you to have separate desktops for the different kinds of things you do into these separate areas. It's kind of hard to explain, but maybe I can do it by example. You have your desktop open right now, and you probably have Windows open for web browsing and email and maybe some office automation, so maybe there's 10 or 15 of these silly windows up there, and all of them are competing for space. You spend a lot of time shoving them out of the way, minimizing them, whatever, to try to get to the things you want. On the Mac, I use the Command Tab to switch between applications, and then I use F10 to show me all the windows in the front application. This is kind of a pain, but it's easier than minimizing the windows and then hunting around in the taskbar or the dock for them. That's where virtual desktops come in handy. You can separate your viewing area into categories of activity, like web browsing and email being in separate desktops. Is that clear at all? It's kind of still kind of confusing. Hearing about it is why I really wanted to test it myself. For years, I've watched Solaris people with four little blocks down on the bottom of the screen, and they'd click on one, and suddenly everything would change to a new set of applications. The virtual desktop application I chose to try out was the free Virtue Desktop from virtuedesktops.info. I haven't even begun to explore all the options available within Virtue, but I'm already enjoying the experience. Virtue does have a lot of great eye candy. I can still use Command Tab to switch between applications, but if my switch changes desktops, I'll see the whole desktop turn into this cube like fast user switching and flip around. It's really fun to do. I do it sometimes just for fun. Virtue allows you to change between 10 different animations, including Cube that I've been using, as well as Flip, which kind of looks like you just flipped over a piece of paper and the other desktop was on the other side, Swap, which is kind of like pulling a piece of paper out from under the one in front. They have a couple that warp the screen that's just crazy weird, and a couple that fade and zoom. You can change how long these animations last to happen, so you can really irritate yourself. After I made it to 2.5 seconds long, which is the maximum, I quickly change it back to the default of 0.5 seconds. I also tried it at 0.1 seconds, but that's just like way too fast. It's kind of creepy, kind of scared me a little bit. There's a whole lot more preferences, but for the life of me, I can't figure out what they're for. Like there's a section on layout and pagers. It has stuff about rows and columns and how pager cells behave. But what the heck's a pager cell? I don't even understand that. I suppose I could go read the documentation, but that's not what you've come to expect from me, is it? So I'm just not going to do it. Overall, I think the effect is pleasing. It helps me to feel a little less cluttered, and I just like it when things change and look different, so I enjoy all the animations going on. I'm not certain it helps in workflow, though, because it becomes harder to drag things between applications since they sort of don't exist in the same place anymore. I did a search for virtual desktops for Windows on Version Tracker, and I found one freeware and 8 shareware ones right off the bat. If it sounds like this might give you some of the organization you've been looking for, go check out one of these tools and have some fun. If I get my nerve up, I'll download the freeware one for Windows and test it on Windows on my Mac. Hey, if any of you test one of these or you've already been using one that you really like, send me an email at allison@podfeet.com and give us a review. So I was listening to Leo Laporte's Call for Help show from Canada, and he had a call from a guy who said that he was running a Mac and he dragged an application out of his dock and suddenly the application was gone. Leo was stumped when I stopped watching, but the guy had mentioned that it wasn't just gone for that user, it was gone for every user. Anywhere he went, he couldn't get back to this application. So Leo left stumped and I ended up finishing up and going to breakfast with my friend Ira, and out of the blue, this very same day, he mentions that his wife had this weird problem that she pulled an app out of the dock and suddenly it was gone for the other users. He figured out what she did, though, and why it happened. Evidently, she had held down the command, or sometimes they call it the Apple key, when she pulled it out of the dock. What happens is that takes the application and it moves it to the desktop. It actually removes it from the application folders. So since it's on that user's desktop now, the other users don't have access to that directory. So the application is completely gone to the other users. It can still be in the dock for the first user, but it won't work on the other users. But actually not having it in the applications folder, depending on the application, can screw it up for that original user. I thought it was pretty weird that I would come up with the exact same thing Leo was trying to solve on the day I heard it. I shot a note over to Leo and told him about it, and he wrote right back that he was glad that I solved the mystery. You know, he kind of leans on me for support like that from time to time. Well, I'm afraid the quality control director, Steve, could not find anything wrong with the podcast last week. He thought I made a mistake, but I made him replay it and proved I was right. So instead, he sent a cool link over. This is really hard to explain in words, too, but I'll give it a try. It's a Honda Civic commercial from England where all of the sound effects were made with human voices. They show you rain hitting the windshield, and you hear and see the windshield wipers moving, and then they show you the people that are actually making those sound effects. You would swear that these are real sounds. Well, I guess they're real sounds, but you know what I mean. Anyway, check it out by going over to honda.co.uk/civic. After it loads, it's kind of a little animation. Click on the button that says watch. And it's pretty cool. If you like it, you might also enjoy watching/listening to the rehearsal. It's pretty fascinating to watch how they teach them to make these noises. So remember when you were promised all those amazing future tech innovations, all those crazy things that were going to happen? Just around the corner was supposed to be a shining technology utopia with flying cars, personal space travel to distant galaxies, and bioimplantable cell phones. Well, ThinkGeek.com says they have the future here and now. It's a Bluetooth laser keyboard. This is a little gadget that stands about 3.5 inches tall, and it shines a red laser down onto the surface in front of you, giving you the outline and letters of a keyboard. Get this, when you type on this imaginary keyboard, it even makes a clicking sound when you hit these virtual keys. It works with a bunch of Bluetooth-enabled PDAs and cell phones. They give a list of compatible devices on the website. It works with Palm OS 5, Pocket PC 2003, Windows Smartphone, Symbian OS, and Windows 2000 and XP. They have limited Mac OS 10 support, like you can't control the brightness and the key repeat rate and sensitivity. They don't include a driver for OS 10, but it works with the OS just as it is. This gadget is the true groundbreaker is $180, but unfortunately they're out of stock right now. But wouldn't it be awesome to whip this baby out in a boring old meeting? I need one. I really, really need one. So lately I've been getting a lot of WMV files from people, and I can't seem to open them. I can get audio only on VLC, but that's it. I keep hearing and reading about this software called Flip for Mac, which is supposed to allow us to watch WMV files inside QuickTime, but it never worked for me. I heard that the reason Microsoft came out with Flip for Mac is because Microsoft wasn't going to support the Mac on new installations of Windows Media Play anymore, so they came out with this to help us watch and listen in QuickTime. I may be getting this all wrong, but it doesn't matter much since it never worked for me anyway. I finally figured out that it doesn't work on Intel-based Macs. Oh, great, but I'm still getting WMV files. What to do? Not to be daunted, I went on a little Google search, and I found Popwire Technologies WMV-9 component available at popwire.com. It's a 20-megabyte file, and the server was pretty slow when I downloaded it, less than 20 kilobytes per second. The installer download is well worth the time because when I ran the simple installer for the universal binary, taking no reboot, no linking it to QuickTime or anything, I launched a WMV file in QuickTime and it opened it right up. It's been so annoying that I haven't been able to open these files. I'm sure I'm missing lots of humor, so this really makes my day. In the instructions, they suggest that you launch the file in the installer disk image called Register Extensions. I know, I said I never read the instructions, but it was an accident. I didn't mean to. Anyway, Register Extensions allows you to create file associations for .asf, .wmv, and .wma files with QuickTime. I did this, but I think it's the same thing as doing a git info on a WMV file and changing the open width dialog to QuickTime and then clicking on Change All. It's a lot easier to do it with the Register Extensions button, though, because it takes care of three file extensions at the same time. For some reason, a few of the WMV files I've received insist that they're Windows Media Player files and will not open with QuickTime. I can tell which ones aren't going to work is because they have the Windows Media Player icon on them. So I don't quite know why some work and some don't, but most of the ones I've gotten have worked. The manual for this software is really well written with nice graphics explaining the menus, as well as special icons to denote notes, tips, and words of caution. I know that sounds like a trivial addition, but it makes this a very readable manual because you can tell what kind of information you're going to get in a particular section. Maybe I read it because it had lots of pictures. Oh well, it got me to read it. I don't take for granted when there's a good user interface, even in something like a manual, because it's far too easy to find poorly written or text-only kind of manuals. If all you want to do is import videos to play, Popwire's WMV-9 component is free, but they also tease you with the ability to do a 20-second export to WMV format. This tease is to show you what you can do if you pay for the full version at $50. For that, $50 US. For that price, you can do exports from QuickTime Pro, Final Cut Pro, iMovie, and Discrete Cleaner. The features they list on the website include Windows Media 9 video and audio, simple and main profile, one pass constant and variable bitrate encoding, support for fractional keyframes, and automatic deinterlace, as well as 32 professional presets. I didn't have anything I needed to export, but I did see in the manual that the presets they talk about allow you to meter your export for a bunch of different options, from the kilobits of streaming you want, the size of the download, whether it's widescreen or not, more options than I can explain here. As I mentioned, this is a universal binary, so on PowerPC Max, it requires 10.3.9 or later, and QuickTime 6.5.2 Pro or later. Pro if you want to do the export. On Intel Max, it requires 10.4.5, and QuickTime 7 Pro or later. If you want a full-featured video export tool, this one looks pretty capable. Check out Popwire WMV-9 component at popwire.com. Well, my son Kyle told me a really fun game to play over at shockwave.com. It's called Inklink, that's I-N-K-L-I-N-K, and it's an online game of Pictionary. If you've never played Pictionary, that's where one person is given a word and they have to draw it so the other people can guess the secret word. In real life, you play on teams, but in Inklink, you're joined by random people, or I guess you could all converge into a room, and you get points by guessing what someone else draws. Well, guessing correctly. And you get points if you draw well enough so that others guess you're drawing quickly. I was able to play Inklink on our G5, but I couldn't get the Flash Player 8 Universal Preview for Intel to load properly, so I can't yet play on the MacBook Pro. But if you're bored tonight, head on over to shockwave.com and click in the search window and enter Inklink and have some fun. My father-in-law is a great resource for insurance. What could be more exciting to talk about on a podcast than insurance? This will be sure to raise my listenership. But seriously, he hooked me up with a cool website that lets you compare trip insurance from several big companies. These trip insurance policies offer coverage for cancellation, interruption, emergency medical evacuation, and even money you'd get paid just if they left you stranded at the airport for 6 hours. That's happened to me. I would have loved to have had some money back for that. Or even if your luggage was late, they'll give you some money so you can buy some clothes. The good news and bad news is that lots of companies offer these kinds of policies and have many different kinds of plans from which to choose. And that's where the site he sent me to comes in. It's called insuremytrip.com. When you start on the site, click on quotes on the left side, and then they ask you to fill in just a few facts about your trip, not near as much as I thought they would, like how much does it cost per person, what kind of trip you're going on, air only, cruise, or other. Then you tell them about the ages of the people on the trip, your areas of residence. They have the United States, all different states, and also some countries, but you can select other if your country isn't there. And finally, the dates of your trip. After you give them those details, you'll be faced with a list of companies and plans within the companies from which to choose. Here's where it gets good, and this site really comes in useful. You can narrow your choice a bit by selecting the ones that might be contenders. Don't worry about selecting a lot of them. And then hit the button that says Compare. All of the plans will be side by side with the same features compared so that you can compare them against each other for cost and the kind of coverage they offer. What I really liked about the usability of this site was that after you've chosen all these plans to compare, You can eliminate them one by one, and they disappear from the comparison. That way, you're not having to try to keep track of so many columns of information. Just blast away the ones you don't like. The combination of usability plus my father-in-law's endorsement of this site, he used to work for the California Insurance Commission, so he knows what he's talking about on insurance, helped me to choose a good plan for our summer vacation. Now I won't worry so much if something might go wrong. Check it out at insuremytrip.com. So I try to really dedicate myself to giving you tools that actually solve a problem we have, but I'm going to diverge from that. I'm not really sure this tool solves a problem, but it's still an interesting little freeware Mac utility. It's called Mouse Locator, and its purpose is to provide a highly visible locator to instantly reveal your mouse position. It does this by making two big, bright green concentric circles around your mouse when you first wiggle it after it's been at rest for a bit. You can set the trigger delay, which is how long the mouse has to be at rest before the mouse locator will kick into gear. At first, I set it to 2 seconds, and man, was that annoying. Every time I moved the mouse, it was blasting me with these great big circles. You can set the trigger time from 1 second to 30 minutes. You can also adjust how long the circles hang around after first alerting you to where your cursor has wandered off to. Mouse Relocator is available from 2point5fish.com. That's the number 2, P-O-I-N-T, the number 5, then fish.com. And on that site, you can download alternative symbols, different colors, different shapes to identify the cursor. They even have an area where people have uploaded different symbols if you don't like the standard green circles. It's a lot of fun to mess around with, and I know it's going to come in useful too. I especially need Mouse Relocator when I'm playing VLC videos. My mouse is always disappearing on me. So I'll see if I'm going to need it. I'm not sure, but it seemed like fun. By the way, macOS 10.4 or later is required. Google keeps coming up with cool things. I don't know how they do it, but they have another neat one. This one was sent in by my buddy Ron. It's called Google Trends, available at google.com/trends. The idea is that you enter a search term, and Google Trends will show you a graph of how often that term was searched for as a function of time. Ron tested it by typing in the names of 3 recent hurricanes, and you could see the activity lined up with when those hurricanes actually hit. As Ron said, it really gives you a picture of what's on everyone's mind as a function of time. I typed in podcasting, and it shows that it was first requested back in the fourth quarter of 2004. And then you can see peaks with different events highlighted on the right, such as the peak in activity after iTunes got podcasting and articles that hit the news about podcasting. There's no scale on the graph, which is kind of lame, but they do show a second graph, which is how much news activity there was as a function of time. You can use the 2 pull-downs to look at the same trend graphs, but by region and date span. For example, the default is to look for all regions and all years. I changed the region to France and later Australia, and both countries showed podcasting as a search term didn't take off until almost mid-2005 instead of late 2004, like all regions said. The graph for the United Kingdom looked more like the all regions version and showed it being launched in or searched for in Q4 2004. Anyway, check it out at google.com/trends, and thanks for the cool tip, Ron. Last week, I mentioned that I had asked PodTrack to start tracking statistics on how many downloads I was getting and from where, but then in a couple of weeks, they still weren't reporting anything. I wrote to them again this week, and they dug into the problem and finally noticed that they had entered my URL using all lowercase characters, but in my feed, NoSillaCast has a capital N and a capital C in it. Unix is case-sensitive, so it turns out that's pretty important. They fixed it, and now I'm getting real download information. I love statistics, so the graphs and the data are all really fun to look at. I also mentioned in my podcast last week that I might consider doing a bit of advertising, but I was hesitant on this because it can be so overbearing on some podcasts. Listener Margaret suggested that I think of podcasting as street performing, so put out a virtual hat and see if people throw in donations. I decided to take her advice, so I'm working on getting a PayPal donation button set up on the site. I'm kind of lame at coding, so I'm having trouble getting it to work, but perhaps by the time this airs, it'll be up and running. If it is, and you wouldn't mind throwing in a few bucks now and then, that would be most excellent. Well, that's going to wrap it up this week for the 1-year anniversary episode of the NoSillaCast. Thanks to everyone who's been with me from the beginning and to those of you who just joined us this week. Please send in your feedback, questions, suggestions, and any cool tools or websites you come across to Allison at podfeet.com. Thanks for listening and stay subscribed.